in both azimuth and elevation. As long as your individual elements have a pattern that has a fairly big null in that direction, or at least a lot of suppression of signal in that direction, then you will be suppressing those lobes. You can see a lot of these lobes and the effects of both the good and the bad effects of having them there by studying the radio telescopes. Many of the radio telescopes are a large number of elements with a significant number of wavelengths between them. Krauss's book and Steinberg and LeCue are the two major books. The book called Radio Astronomy by John Krauss gives you some beautiful computer-generated plots of what a multi-element radio telescope is like. So the elements of a radio telescope and the individual transmitting and receiving elements of a ultrasonic acoustic array that's giving you ultrasonic imaging inside of a human being, believe it or not, it is almost the exact same mathematics. Or the acoustic array that's used on a submarine to steer the beam in order to find out where the torpedoes are and where the other ships are. It's all the exact same physics. So you can steer that beam in acoustics, ultrasonics, VHF, UHF, microwave, millimeter wave, wherever you like. Optical, there are optical kinds of phased arrays. So also, and by the way, when you really study what's going on inside of a horn antenna or inside of a parabolic dish antenna, and where's the gain coming from? It is the equivalent of a phased array. Each individual square centimeter of that parabolic dish is a recognizable separate element that you could study electronically in order to reconstruct the beam that comes out of that antenna. And if you study it in that manner, let me drop, you can figure out exactly what's going to happen if you move the feed horn off to one side on a parabolic dish antenna without moving the dish. You can electronically steer the beam out of a parabolic dish by six wavelengths, six beam widths, by moving nothing but the horn, as long as you've got a large focal length of diameter radio dish. That was covered in the book by Silver in the Radiation Laboratory series. Rad Lab number 11, I think it is, called Antennas, by Silver. He's got a chapter in there telling you you can steer the beam six beam widths by moving only the horn without moving the rest of the dish before the gain falls off by 1 dB. So there's lots of ways of doing it, but in general, large spacings are going to give you a whole bunch of other lobes if you haven't taken steps to eliminate them. And in the case of a radio telescope, there are occasions where those extra lobes can be used to an advantage to give you a higher resolution picture of what that star pattern is like out there. Look what you started with all this, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. You're absolutely right, Dick. It's interesting. And it always, those fingers lead out in all directions, so we never know where we're going to go, what road we're going to go down when we open the subject. But that's it from Mel's mailbag, and it's been a pleasure. So let's carry on. Maybe Paul's ready with the space report.
Yeah. Hey, there's been a beautiful landing on SpaceX. Came to the International Space Station. A whole lot of hardware was delivered. And I think they're looking forward to eventually in the near future shipping human beings by that system. So for the first time in history, a commercial business did a major installation, is not the right word, a major application, a major delivery of hardware to the International Space Station. So NASA has gotten into the commercial world. It's more than just putting the toe in the water. Give us some more words on this one, Paul. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, WS2N. The Dragon successfully was birthed to the space station. That was on Friday. It took off on Tuesday from Cape Canaveral. The rocket that launched it was also commercially built, the Falcon 9. Nine being that means that it has nine engines. Now, this thing was delayed back in February, and then they had software problems, and they delayed it into April, and again, more software problems. And software problems dealing with the Dragon spacecraft. They needed to know that it could properly abort autonomously if there was something wrong, you know, or get crew inside the space station, they could direct it to back off if they had to. So that had to all be squared away. And then last week they did try to take off, and they had a failure of the number 5 rocket in the Falcon 9, and they worked on it. Apparently some kind of check valve problem with the fuel. Got that squared away, and it took off when we dropped it. A couple of days later, the crew on board, 6 people on board the space station, finally grappled this thing. And it is, it looks like a round disc, if you're looking at it, on the back part of the Dragon spacecraft. Not the, what I would call the command module part, the... like this, you know, if it was manned, you'd have like a service module with solar arrays sticking out. It doesn't grab that part. It actually grabs the, I'll call it the command module part. The 58-foot robotic arm built by Canada, which is permanently attached to the space station, was directed to put this thing to dock it in the... one of the ports by the Harmony node, one of the parts of the space station that's set up for this type of thing. And then the next day they open it up, slide the door open, and they go in with masks, and they're always careful. They get glasses in case something's floating around. Let me drop it. All the crafts, the H-2 by Japan, the Progress ships by Russia, and the ATVs, the automatic transfer vehicles sent by European Space Agency, they always go in there first with masks and safety glasses. And in this case, there was nothing floating around. From what I read, they were impressed by all the hardware, the way everything was secured, and the engineering that was on the inside of this thing. And maybe 3-4 years from now, this cargo vehicle will be converted into a vehicle to take our crews up to the space station and also back down. And, they said 3-4 years. Well, if you think about it, Don Pettit now is the first one to actually occupy this thing in space. So, as far as I'm concerned, it's already a manned vehicle. And they went inside, and the next couple of days they'll be taking things out and sewing it into the space station, 1,200 pounds worth of stuff. And next couple days after that, bring science equipment and things that have to go back, good stuff that they want to bring back to Earth, because this is the only one that can do that, the only cargo vehicle that can return to Earth. The other one burned up over the Pacific. This is actually going to land with parachutes right near a boat 250 miles off the coast of California, and they'll take it out of the water and bring all the science stuff back and drop it. So that all went very well, and I think it's going to be attached to the space station for quite a few days now, and then eventually deorbit, and they'll bring it back on the 31st of this month. So, it's the first time in history that a commercial company was able to do something like this. There's other ones planned. Because of this, they're going to wind up with a contract from NASA. I believe it's $1.5 billion contract to bring 12 of these cargo vehicles up in the next year or so. So, and then not 1,200 pounds. This is like a demo. We're talking about 6,000 or 7,000 pounds in the future, Dick. Talk about that. We've been talking about this thing for forever. We drop it. One other thing for the space portion of it, and that I just wanted to bring up, talking about radio astronomy. Australia and South Africa has gotten together with some other 8 countries involved in what they call the SKA, or Squared Kilometer Array, big radio astronomy setup. Going to be distributed between South Africa and Western Australia and I believe New Zealand is also involved as far as locations for these things. And what it is they're going to have all these things connected to one another. So it will actually be like one gigantic telescope. Well, they go by kilometers. I figured that was 1,900 miles, roughly 2,000 miles from one end to the other of these gigantic arrays, thousands and thousands of them. And the first phase will be brought up, I think, within about 3 or 4 years, and then another phase after that, and another one by, 2024. Let me drop it to WS2N. So, it's going to cover all these different frequencies from 70 megahertz all the way up to 10 gig. And then finally the third phase that's eventually going to be built will go all the way up to 30 gig, from 70 meg to 10 meg, and then eventually all the way up to 30 gig. The lower frequencies are all going to be done with gigantic dipoles. Gigantic setup of dipoles, hundreds and thousands of these things. And then eventually they'll go all the way up to the dishes. And talk about phased array, they're going to be all done with the phased array system. Interferometry is what they're going to use, all these supercomputers and everything to get the signals back. As far as resolution, what they expect to see, it should be 50 times the whatever resolution they can get now with anything. But the idea of the phased arrays, because it's all done electronically, they'll be able to scan the skies 10,000 times faster, move things around. So it's going to be a big help. They'll be looking for dark matter, dark energy they're going to get involved with, and even ET signals, they'll be looking for them. So those are the two topics, Dragon and the SKA squared kilometer array. The United States is not involved in that telescope program. Everything's also south of the equator, of course. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
So the Falcon 9, which I think was the booster, and the Dragon, I think is the name of the vehicle, that delivered always something like 1,000 pounds or 1,500 pounds of raw materials, hardware, of consumables to the International Space Station last Friday. And then I think you say it's going to be docked for about a week, and then whatever that has to be returned to Earth is going to be loaded inside, and it's going to come back down, land a couple hundred miles off the western coast of California by way of parachute. However, when that vehicle leaves the International Space Station and does its deorbit burn and then goes through the atmosphere, is there a heat shield on it? Is there an ablative heat shield? Is this thing a bell-shaped object, sort of like the command module of Apollo 9, of Apollo? So I'm guessing you can't use the parachutes at first. There's got to be you've got to deorbit from the 17,500 miles an hour. You've got to come down to a few hundred miles an hour before you deploy the parachute. Otherwise, you just rip the parachute off. So there must be an ablative heat shield that I hadn't thought about up till now. And is there a limit on the number of pounds that can come back down? Because all of the energy to deorbit that material, to slow it down through the atmosphere, has to be absorbed by that heat shield. So I'm guessing there is a limit to how many pounds can be brought back down. Give me a couple of words on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
When the Dragon is operational, it's supposed to be, 6,000 or 7,000 pounds going up or down. And it does have the heat shield. Whether or not it's ablative like the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo program shields, I don't know. I think it's a different kind of material. I'm trying to think back. I don't believe it's ablative. Yeah, whatever it's made of, I think it's going to pretty much remain intact. Whether they change it out every time there's a flight, I would imagine they probably do. But good question. They do have retro rockets on these things. It blends in with the, you know, it's with the cone shape, the bottom part of it. You know, they don't stick out. I mean, it's really a nice design. And these rockets are also going to be used for emergency. Instead of having a tractor type system where there's a like a tower on top of the spacecraft with rockets at the top of the tower pulling the spacecraft away, they'll have this push type of system where instead of being pulled like a tractor, they're going to be pushed by these rockets that are mounted on the side of the spacecraft in case there's a problem. Now, if they don't use them, drop it. There won't be an emergency. What they'll be eventually used for, you know, in the future will be landing on land. You know, you'll come down close to the land, and similar to what the Russians do with the Soyuz. If you ever watch those landings, they come down with a parachute. At the very end, you see rockets go off to soften the blow. Well, this is going to be one step further. Eventually, these rockets are actually going to land this thing. that's some years away, but according to the website SpaceX, if you look at the animation, that's the way they'll have it. Same for the Falcon 9. Same for the second stage of the Falcon 9, which is just really another one of these same rockets. You know, they have 9 rockets in the first stage. The second stage has one, and they'll refire this thing to land that thing eventually and reuse it. Interesting to watch this whole setup you know, when you go to SpaceX. So everything will be eventually reusable. That's the plan. Back to you, Dave.
Nice stuff. And because of the design of the Falcon and Dragon, doesn't have the arrangement where you've got something like a large external tank with cryogenic materials inside that's doing what's called a cryogenic loading. In other words, no insulation is perfect, so therefore when the cryogenic materials are sitting in that tank and they're sitting on the launch pad for 48 hours, you develop some ice on the outside surface. And if that ice flakes away and hits the rest of the active portions of the vehicle, it can do all kinds of damage, as it did in Columbia. And so Falcon doesn't have any surfaces behind that can be interfered with in that manner. So that's a
good too. You know, that's liquid.
Yeah, but it's got liquid fuel. But what's behind? Are there any vital portions of the vehicle where chunks of ice can fall off that cryogenic tank and hit something else vital on the vehicle? Back to you, Paul.
No, I know what you mean now. Well, you've got your engines are actually gimbal on the bottom. I guess you could break something there. Or if something fails, you do have the escape system, like I just mentioned. I got you. Yeah, but I was just saying they have the liquid oxygen and it's a kerosene system. Liquid oxygen, kerosene rockets is what they use.
Question? Yeah, John recognized. But if the liquid oxygen tank, which is cryogenic, builds up some ice, and if that ice falls off, it can only hit the shroud around the rocket engine at the bottom. And if that shroud is made strong enough, I think the ice impacting it would dent it, but it might not stop the operation of the engine. Over to you, John. I mean, over to you first, Paul, for a comment on that one, and then pass it over to John. WS2N, group, K2RIW.
Got it. No, yeah, eventually they'll, when they fly people, eventually they'll have a heavy lift version, which amounts to two more of these rockets attached, you know, instead of having, like, I guess 9, you'll have 11 rockets, you know. Whether or not I think they're the same too. Yeah, they're going to be the same. They're not going to be like, you know, the solid booster rockets. So I guess anything that falls off could hit them, Yeah, I don't think there's anything to worry about. You're right about that, Dick. Just going to hit the side of it. There won't be any problem with the cryogenics. Back to you, Dick.
And although it sounds kind of hokey, I wish the space shuttle designing people had realized that no matter what they use for insulation, no matter how well they install the insulation, there's always going to be an ice buildup around those cryogenic tanks. So I think a possible solution to that would have been some form of external heater to melt the ice, so to speak. It could have been a bunch of infrared bulbs aimed at that portion which are known to be collecting ice. It's just one possible brute force approach, because it didn't take a very big chunk of ice falling off at hypersonic speeds hitting the leading edge of the Columbia to do the damage. You got it, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the group.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, that's a good idea. Maybe even like heat trace cabling, which could fall off as it takes off. It would do the job. Absolutely. Paul may have mentioned this, but I didn't hear it. When is this craft supposed to return to Earth? Do we have a date?
You got it, Paul.
As the end of the month, 31st, should be the re-entry date, John.
Which is what, 4 days away or so, Paul?
I guess, yeah. What's today? Today's Sunday. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I guess, what, Thursday? I think it's the 31st. I'm not looking at a calendar right now. I'm just guessing.
So you're about to fly out to California to see that landing there, John?
Oh, I'd love to be there, but I'm definitely going to be looking for it on TV. This is going to be an interesting descent. I really want to see that. But very interesting. Thank you, Paul. KC2WGB.
John, they've done it before.
Yeah, tell us about where they've done it before. Did they land the same way on the test vehicle? And have they stated what time the landing will be so we know when to look at our television? Over to you, Paul.
I don't have a landing time. I don't. Not yet. I don't even know if it's been established. You know, they could leave it there another day or two, but right now I know it's planned for the 31st. December of last year, they ran a test flight. Didn't go to the space station, but it did two orbits, and it made sure everything worked okay. It maneuvered in space. They brought it back. The only thing it didn't do was open up its solar panels. They didn't have that planned. They did that on this flight. It returned to Earth right on the mark. I mean, within a couple miles, I think very close, right to the ship that picked it up, which was also a SpaceX ship. So that worked out quite well, and they brought that back. And the flight before that was just a suborbital flight, so of course that worked out okay, but that was into the Atlantic. But last flight, they actually did a couple orbits and brought it back. Back to you, Dick.
Dick, good point. What do they do with the solar panel on reentry?
Yeah, Paul's going to tell us about the solar panels, which I guess are powering all the electronics that allows you to fire the squibs, to do all the maneuvering in space, to fire the re-entry, the retro rockets, and so on. But another thing I'd like to know about, I have this great question, and I've forgotten about it. Let's let Paul answer that one so far. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, the solar panels are attached to what I call the service module. I don't know what they're calling it on SpaceX. But, you know, I remember on the Apollos and the Gemini, you had the capsule in the front, the manned portion. And then you had the service module in the back, which, you know, consisted of all your fuels and tanks and rockets for re-entries, you know, and or even maneuvering. So attached to these, what I'm calling the service module, is the solar panels, two solar panels that came out. So when this thing comes back, it's going to separate from the service module, and then you'll have what looks like the capsule of a Saturn rocket, Saturn spacecraft. So just that portion comes back. The panels stay with the service portion of the spacecraft. Back to you, Dick.
What suddenly occurred to me, Paul, when you talked about the ship that picked it up, that's a big endeavor economically. The design, development, and flying of all of these vehicles for Falcon and the SpaceX vehicles, Falcon 9 and Dragon, we're talking about lots and lots of megabucks here. Where did all that financing of a company that previously was unknown to me, where did all that financing come from, Paul? I think I've read that somebody like Bill Gates or some other fairly rich person, maybe a couple of those guys, decide to invest in this company. Is that approximately what happened? Where did all those megabucks come from, Paul? From US2N, K2RIW?
That was Elon Musk. Comes out of South Africa originally. He's a young guy, he's in his 40s. And he started Space Exploration, I think it was called, something or other. Now it's shortened to SpaceX, you know. It's headquartered in California. Actually, that's where Mission Control was. You know, it was when they were communicating with the spacecraft, and telemetry and all was really not even, they weren't even involved with Houston. I mean, they did, of course, with the docking and all. That was a joint effort. So, yeah, this guy was, he's really into the space business. He's one of the guys that got PayPal started. So, I'm sure he got big money from that. And, I believe you remember the story about the Tesla car, one with all the millions of little batteries in it, gonna go a couple hundred miles an hour. He was also, he started that company too, Dick. Remember that guy?
Yes, I think I do. And there's an article that appeared in Electronic Design News in the last week or two talking about the bearing erosion that you get from brushless DC motors. The very large brushless DC motors that are used for electronic vehicles have this other nasty problem that they haven't really solved yet, and that is the very strong magnetic fields that are made by the rotating magnetic field assembly of your switching structure that gives you the brushless DC motor operation induces some significant voltages into the shaft of the motor, which in turn get introduced into the bearings on the motor. Therefore, some really healthy currents and voltages are flowing through the ball bearings of the motor, and it hits those ball bearings. And I don't know if anyone has found a solution to that yet. I mean, in many cases, the thickness of the oil or grease that's in that bearing is so thin that it gets arced through by that voltage, and therefore you're doing electronic mechanical forming and pitting of the race and the ball bearings in these motors. There's an article in Electronic Design News, which I can give you guys a reference for, describing that and showing you pictures of it. So I think there's going to have to be some kind of, an insulated ceramic structure on the shaft would only give you a partial solution. You're still going to get a magnetic field coupled into the remainder of that shaft that's underneath the bearing. I guess one possible approach would be to electronically float the bearing, to put an insulator around the race of the bearing so that the voltage can appear on those ball bearings without creating a current flow. I wonder if anyone's heard about that one. It's a new problem being recognized on the long-range aging, so to speak, of electronic vehicles. And maybe if Eric is within earshot, he may have run into that. So anybody wants to make a comment on this one, give me your call letters right now.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Anyone too bad they can't use the extra power and everything to create a magnetic bearing situation where you wouldn't need oil, you know. Check it out. Take all that energy and set up some kind of a magnetic field between the shaft and the main bearing.
Yeah, the floating electronic, what are they called now? Maglev. If you're using maglev on that bearing, that's one possible approach. I think a simpler approach is simply to put an insulated structure on the race of the bearing. If you insulate the bearing from the rest of the housing, you interrupt the current flow, I believe. Let's see if anyone else has a a comment on this. Eric might, if he happens to be within earshot. K2LIW listening.
N2WGF for the comment.
N2WGF, start up with your name, sir, and then tell us anything. You've got it, sir.
Okay, the name is Jerry. I'm a retired motor engineer, actually. EDM in motor bearings is a common problem. We've had it for kind of centuries. And insulating the bearing races is one of the ways to solve part of it. On big big motors and generators over 5,000 horsepower, we generally put a ground brush assembly on one of the shafts.
Yeah, EDM, I think, stands for electronic something machining. In other words, by passing current, arcing current through a metallic structure, you can be whittling away some of the material. Isn't that sort of what EDM stands for? Up to you, Jerry.
QSL, it's electro discharge machining. Anytime you have two metal objects, like a shaft rotating in another shaft, the Tesla effect, you will be generating the voltage. Most of the time, we see a lot of it with what we used to call sleeve bearings. It's a little less pronounced in the ball bearing types, but in any case, one of the first things we do is we insulate one side of that bearing, one side of the shaft. The other shaft is left grounded to limit the current, because you're going to have a current flowing through the armature of that machine. It's not only going to be generated in the bearing structure. Let me drop it. You're going to have a current flowing through both ends in a machine, so we like to ground one side of it, and then we insulate the other, or the insulated bearing. And that's fairly common on motors over, say, 50 to 100 horsepower. But when you're dealing with DC machines, obviously the currents are going to be more pronounced. And it's an AC current that's actually being generated, which kind of creates the arcing.
What stops, Jerry, what stops them from insulating the bearing on both sides so that now both sets of bearings are electronically floating? Let the voltage appear on the shaft, no current flows, no disadvantages. What stops them from insulating both bearings on both sides of that shaft? Over to you, Jerry. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick. Well, one of the reasons why we never insulated both sides is you got a giant capacitor there, and you can build up really, really high voltages on the shaft. On main turbo generators, I've actually seen sparks jump almost 2 or 3 inches across a insulated bearing structure, so it can be pretty hefty. So you want it somewhere. You got to let the current go someplace. So you like to get some of it out of the, you want to electrically neutralize it. That's why we want to ground only one side. I wonder if it's something similar to grounding just one end of a coax cable. I guess that might be one of the examples. Over.
Yeah, because of the strength of the magnetic field and the rate at which it's changing in a brushless DC motor, I am guessing that the impedance of that current flow through the bearing could be huge. And to try to short it out with shorting brushes, I think is a tough way to go. To insulate the bearing is a beautiful solution. Yes, now you've got electrostatic buildup capability because you've got dissimilar metals. You've got what's called the... why can't I think of the name of it now? The voltage you build up with dielectric materials, differing dielectric materials, what's the name of that electromagnetic, that electrovoltage series? Why can't I think of the name of it?
Electrolysis stick?
No, it's not electrolysis. It's got another name. What's the name of electrostatic? There's a table of materials where you know which one's going to be positive, which one's going to be negative, and by how much. When you know where your material is on that table.
Are you thinking about Peltier effect?
No, it's not Peltier. I can't think of the name of it. It's not the electromotive series. There's another whole series. But anyhow, for electrostatic materials, and you've got electrostatic materials in that motor being rotated, and therefore you're going to be building up DC current. So by insulating the bearings on both sides, you stop the very low impedance, very high current flowing through the bearing from taking place. Now a simple grounding mechanism can ground out the electrostatic voltage buildup, because I am guessing although you can get thousands of volts built up there, I'm guessing the electrostatic voltage buildup is a much smaller current capability. Does that sound approximately true, Jerry? N2WGF, I think it is, K2RIW?
K2RIW, N2WGF. Well, actually, I'm more familiar with it on a very large scale, like on a 1,000-megawatt generator. A simple carbon brush is all you need. The idea is to keep that electrostatic potential from building up in the first place. Don't forget, as that shaft is rotating in the magnetic field, it's also vibrating. And as that's vibrating, it's also causing, a coupling effect. Or it's actually like a coil vibrating inside another coil. So you're building up an electrical field around that rotating element, as well as a static charge, as well as the Tesla effect. So the only way to keep that down, we used a simple a ground brush. But in ball bearing motors, generally only one side again is insulated. I'm not certain what the insulation or what the design of most of these type of motors are, but in most cases, the EBM is caused by high-speed electrical discharge, mostly static. Over.
Thomas? Yeah, the word I was looking for is called triboelectric series. The triboelectric list, or triboelectric series, tells you if, for instance, I bring together a PVC rod and a piece of fur, and I rub one against the other, depending on how far separated on the triboelectric list the two materials are, when they come in contact and then they're separated, develops how much voltage. I can see now what's going on here, I think, and that is the shaft itself completes the circuit between the bearing on the left side of the shaft, the bearing on the right side of the shaft, the armature in between, and the rotating magnetic field by the stepper motor function, if you know what I mean. By insulating one bearing on one side, you've interrupted most of that path. And now there is no complete circuit anymore by which current can flow through the bearing. So one bearing being grounded, one bearing floating, gives you simultaneously grounding for the static voltage buildup and the interruption of this very high EDM current that can flow through the bearing. That looks like a beautiful solution. To your knowledge, Jerry, before we go over to the other people who want to make comment, to your knowledge, are most of the real high-power, multi-horsepower motors used at the wheels of electronic vehicles, are they all using one insulated bearing to get around this problem? Over to you, Jerry, K2RIW.
Right now, I think they're looking at it. Most of the time, that's a relatively small machine. So most of the time on small machines, it wasn't thought to be necessary to insulate one side of the bearing. I would be willing to bet you they're going to start doing it really quickly if that's the case. And one of the other things, if it was a ball bearing design, we didn't normally insulate at both sides of the bearings. But now we have something that I got a feeling they're going to look at that solution, and it's probably one of the ones they're going to go by. Over.
That sounds right. Who else wanted to make a comment? K2RIW.
And to Gian.
You got it, Wes.
Well, the most common source of the shaft voltage is parasitic coupling from the starter of ports with modulated feed of asynchronous modules. There are plenty of components in it. Bearing damages increased in PWM depends on the electric welding in the common lead applied to the wrong spot, the locomotive grounding through the bearings or calculating current through the shaft, or and bearing and electrostatic discharge that is called EDM. But it's a number of problems with it. Depends from that if you have a DC or you have an AC, but it's very much uncommon that happen with the DC. Let me jump. But but the different motors have different problems, and some of the symptoms of that is the capacitive coupling or frame voltage or inductive couplings of that. And they try to fight with it, trying to actually calculate the capacitance and the charge voltage across the capacitance and insulation. And eventually, that's what the gentleman was telling, which was the insulation failure, which one side of the bearing was insulated and the other one was not. But those are the symptoms that could be avoided when we're talking about EDM and to
HCM. Okay, now, I wonder if your electronic vehicle has run into any problems like this, Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
Just a little comment. On the small side of things, with small motors in the old days of the broadcast videotape machine, what the manufacturers did is they actually put a little button on the end of the shaft, and the shaft was connected to ground because you're essentially picking up a rather weak FM signal from, you can think of it, even though it's a magnetic pole fit, you can think of it as an antenna because you had FM on the tape, and without that little button, the static discharge, even though well grounded at both ends, ball bearings, because the motors were running at 3600 RPM. And also, as another comment, the electric vehicle, the hybrid vehicle that I drive, also has a contactor on the shaft. So what its function is, I don't really know. I only know from what I've seen the motor taking apart. So just a comment. H-R-W-K-2-J.
When I was a youngster, I do remember that the grease cap that was over the bearing of the front wheels of an automobile always had a little spring device in the center which pressed on the shaft or the non-moving portion of the bearing, and it literally grounded the rim of the wheel where the tire is mounted to the non-rotating portion of the shaft. Because the grease that you had in there was an insulator, and so you used to pick up static electricity from the tire rolling on the road, particularly on a macadam road. That static in turn would interfere with the proper operation of the radio, so you had to make sure that those grounding devices were doing their job so that the radio would work correctly. I noticed that all modern day vehicles no longer have that. I am guessing the problem was solved by putting conductive materials in the rubber of the tire so that the tire is continuously being grounded to the road and is no longer thoroughly insulated, which then makes you ask some interesting questions. What about during a lightning storm when lightning strikes the vehicle? Well, the fact that you've got the Faraday cage around you is where the protection is taking place. The fact that the tires are a quasi-insulator between the automobile and the rest of the earth is a secondary effect. But I wonder if you guys remember when those grounding devices used to be on the bearings of automobiles in the late 40s, and lately I haven't seen that. So I'm guessing the tires are made conductive, or some other grounding mechanism was built into the bearing, which I'm doubtful of. I don't remember seeing those brushes. Anybody with a comment on that? Give me your call letters, K2RIW.
And 2XGN.
Go ahead, Wes.
It wasn't really to force the presence of these long strips. Was actually till 90s very often almost in every car in Europe, but maybe in here is a change. But that's what you said. I have a few doubts about that spring. The result is that the rotor discharges in the other bearings. The bearings with the lower breakdown voltage somehow varies stochastically over the time. Like staccato, it breaks down first. If there is only one bearing, the earliest breakdown voltage gets higher. So the energy is proportional to the voltage squared. Discharge energy and damage increases. What do you think about that? And to XGN.
I do remember staticky noise appearing in the AM car radio of my father's automobile in the late 40s, and we discovered that the grease cap over the wheel had the spiral spring mechanism with a little pointer in the center that went between the rotary portion of the wheel bearing and the stationary portion where you've got the castle nut and the cotter pin. It pressed down on the center of that shaft, and if that spring inside the grease cup was broken, you would pick up static electricity and a ticking sound, a staticky sound in the radio. As I said, they no longer do that these days. I'm guessing the design of the tires is the major reason. Well, in those days, I don't think they were using steel belting. Now that you've got steel belting in the tires,
I have the answer.
I'm listening.
The answer is capacitor coupling. The non-typical case is rather very easy to be noticeable for the large motor. So the both shafts and in phase is important. That means that the shaft voltage doesn't go to zero and stays there, but oscillates with a high frequency determined by the bearing capacitance and the local inductance. So the rotor inductance and the capacitance reacts like a low pass filter. The oscillation then can hardly be seen. Enter again.
When the Timken roller bearings, the nut ball bearings, they're cone-shaped bearings, when they're well lubricated, there's a layer of grease between those two which insulates them. So you do build up a static electric charge when the tire rolls over the road. And as such, the automobile is at a different potential from the earth. And across that a thousandth of an inch, let's say, grease layer on those bearings, there is an insulation, and you break down that insulation when the voltage gets high enough, and it makes a static discharge.
Yeah, but you have a shaft voltage and you have a flux arrow that is usually pointing down. The example of the spring that you're talking about. So the terms of, let's say, phases that makes out the pulse wave modulating voltage does not equal zero. So the resulting non-zero stray current is going from starter winding via capacitor to the ground in typical motor. So the stray current invokes the magnetic field that is contrary to the sine field and induce the voltage in the motor shaft. And the voltage then can reach a certain amount in peak or more in the motor. If we're talking about the car, we can also talk about the electrical motor. There is the same analogy in terms of the bearings. And that's it.
I'm pretty sure, Wes, you're discussing an electronic vehicle. I'm discussing an old-fashioned gasoline-powered vehicle, 1949 vintage. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Oh, you're absolutely right, Dick. Those springs were in there, and that's what they were for exactly. What I believe happened is we have metal bearing grease now, which we didn't have before, and I believe it's slightly conductive, so that may be the discharge right there.
Oh-ho. As such, I'm now, when I leave the TechNet tonight, I'm going to take my own meter to my little pot of grease that I grease my bearings with and find out if it's conductive. And in the old days, I guess it wasn't conductive. So you believe they've made the grease conductive. That's one approach. I think with the steel belting of the tires, there's another effect that's giving you a discharge. And some vehicles have a long strap of material that hangs from the vehicle and touches the road, which supposedly discharges the vehicle when you've got your fur coat on and you slide across the plastic seats and you touch the doorknob and you get a shock. And that supposedly discharges that. I'm a little skeptical as to whether or not that can really do the discharge, because the voltage buildup in that case is between you and the vehicle. You're a floating object inside of, insulated from the metal of the vehicle, the Faraday cage that you're inside of, and I'm having trouble believing that strapped to the ground is going to make a significant difference. That would only make a difference if I was walking from the road and walking over to the vehicle. That's not where we're getting the discharge most of the time. So you think it's conductive grease. You might be right. Steel belting the tires, I think, is another factor. And maybe the rubber itself is made mildly conductive. I'm going to conduct a couple of experiments with my high impedance digital voltmeter. My DVM in the megohm scale. By the way, there are a few kinds of ohm meters that you can get that really read high number of ohms. There's a whole thread of questions being asked on the microwave reflector over the last 4 days as to how do you generate a well-defined tera-ohm resistor, 10 to the 12 ohm resistor. various guys are saying that, well, you take a 3x5 card and you put a pencil line across it and you put a clip lead on both sides, to which somebody else came along and said, well, that's just going to be a hygrometer. As the humidity goes up and down, the impedance of that's going to go up and down.
Well, big multi...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, to solve the problem of the tera-ohm resistor built by a pencil marking on a 3x5 card, various people said, well, you've got to shellac it or cover it with some other kind of material to make sure the humidity is not going up and down. Somebody else said that, yeah, we've done that experiment, and as I breathe on it, the impedance changes very little. It's not humidity sensitive, because the humidity of a card has got very little to do with the conductivity of the carbon trace that you put across it. Turns out that pure water is an extremely good insulator. So now you've got to worry about what's the salt content of the moisture that the card sucks up. And is there remaining salt in the way the card was designed, or was the way it was manufactured, so that moisture on it is going to change its conductivity. Other people have built make-ohm resistors by putting a small amount of salt into a plastic tube, a long plastic tube of water. And that's one way of doing it. I know that I had the problem in which I wanted to make a 10 to the 14 ohm resistor in order to make a voltage divider network on my electrostatic voltmeter. I own a very precision electrostatic voltmeter that goes to 30,000 volts. But my WIMSARS machine can put out 200 kilovolts, and I'd like to measure the 200 kilovolts without discharging the machine. And you need a real high impedance not to do that. Which also reminds me of, let me drop. One of the very nice articles that Wesley mailed to us, when you go to Bernie@huntfamily.com, and you look up of all the things that Wesley has provided, one of them was an article labeled Space Telegraph. He mailed that one on May 21 at 1:09 a.m. When you go to that particular patent for a space telegraph, it essentially is a Wimshurst machine, and you realize that this is a 1909 equivalent of a spark gap transmitter, which runs on DC voltage, not AC voltage. Now that's the difference between spark and arc. I think that's the major difference. If you're using a DC supply to run your spark-like transmitter, they call it an arc transmitter. The theory of operation is rather similar. So this multi-stack wheeled Wimshurst machine, and by the way, if you want to know what a Wimshurst machine looks like, you go to John's website, QRZ.com, and you look at the photographs of the machinery that's in his laboratory. That disc-shaped object that's sitting on his desk is a Wimshurst machine, and when that thing is finely tuned and working just right on a nice dry day, it will turn out 200 kilovolts. It will arc a 3 5/8 inch. Is it 3 5/8 inch or is it 5 5/8? Now I'm not sure. Roughly, I think it's 3 5/8. 3 5/8 inches of air it will arc through once every second or so. What a machine. I presume that picture is still on the QRZ.com set of pictures of yours. Is that true, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Yes, it is, Dick. And I believe the element that was added to the grease was molybdenum. And I think that's conductive.
That sounds right. So it's simultaneously conductive and a nice lubricant. But now, what this machine was doing, this so-called space telegraph, it really had a high-voltage Morse code key, which took that, let me pick a number, 200 kilovolts, which is arcing across some gaps, and putting a raspy arcing signal onto an antenna, a tuned circuit, and onto the antenna. And by operating this very large Morse code key, you were interrupting that spark gap, and therefore sending Morse code, it would probably sound something like that over the air. And so these arc/spark transmitters were the major way it was done in the early 1900 time frame. The Titanic was indicating its distress on a spark gap transmitter. That was running off probably a 60 cycle or 400 cycle high voltage power supply that was being stepped up to a high voltage and running the rotary gap machine that was making the tone to the arc. And that was, I think, a real arc transmitter. A spark transmitter. So I wonder, did you get a chance to see this particular so-called space telegraph patent. I wonder if you had a chance to see that one, John. Kind of an interesting looking machine. Part of what's going on there is that it is a Wimpshurst machine with not just a pair of discs. It's got two or four or six discs, 1, 3, or 5 pairs of them, if you know what I mean, in order to generate more and more current. And in theory, you could put them in series and run them in to get a higher voltage. Let me drop. I, for one, bought a pair of Wimpshurst machines. And on multiple occasions, I made the mistake of attempting to put them in series because I thought I was going to double the voltage. Absolutely not. I didn't double the voltage. The arc of each one of them is such that I'm already pushing the insulation of all of the setup. I could get more current out of the machines by putting them in parallel. The machine itself can turn out as something like 5 microamperes. And 5 microamperes, or let's make it 10 microamperes at 200 kilovolts, in order not to load down that machine, you better be putting something like 10 to the 14 ohms across it. Well, you don't go to your RCO7 carbon composition resistors to get a resistor that big. We're talking about thousands of megohms here, or maybe a million megohms. Yeah, a teraohm is a million megohms. You don't see that in your normal parts box. So wonder if you had a chance to see that particular article. It's kind of cute. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Oh, yes, Dick. I read that article and the patent application. What I found interesting is, as we know, because we own them, you have to control humidity. And they had a desiccant pump. And that's what that flask-looking, that funnel-shaped item was. They had some salt in there and some cotton and some spacing material. And they, I believe, pumped about 30 pounds of pressure. That was a sealed box that Wimpshurst machine was in. And they pressurized it to 30 pounds, but they removed the humidity with that little pump. So that was great. Other than that, you know, the device is complicated, but really it's spark generator. Just like you said, it's Morse all over again.
There is a lot of information that John just gave you. The fact that the Wimpshurst machine was in a transparent sealed box that was pressurized with dried air. You do two or three things. By drying the air, you lower the humidity in the box. By operating the box at higher than atmospheric pressure, you increase the dielectric strength of air. That's opposite of common sense. If I measured the breakdown potential of dry air, it is around 30,000 volts per centimeter. If I got two small round spheres on the end of two long metal rods, and I slowly raise the voltage across those two spheres while they're separated by 1 centimeter, at around 30 kilovolts, I'll get an arc for 1 centimeter. So 30,000 volts per centimeter, round rule of thumb, which is 3 million volts per meter, is the dielectric strength of air at atmospheric pressure and normal humidity. If I'm operating my Wimpshurst machine at higher than normal humidity, it isn't that the water is conductive. It's that water with any salts in it are conductive. So the fingerprints that you've got on the discs of your Wimpshurst machine or any salty water that you've got in the vicinity will discharge the machine while it's trying to build up the voltage, and it's not going to build you up as high a voltage as you would like. So pure water itself is an extremely good insulator. If there's no ions in that water, like sodium chloride ions, if you know what I mean, you dissolve salt into water and it becomes a lot more conductive. But pure water is an extremely good insulator. In fact, in dielectric strength, it might be better than air. Pure water, I think, is maybe not 30,000 volts per centimeter. It might be 300. Here we go. It might be 300,000 volts per centimeter. I know it's a bigger number if the water is pure enough.
1,000 volts per millimeter.
Okay, 1,000 volts per millimeter is, let me think, 1 millimeter is 10 centimeters. So that would be 300,000 volts per centimeter, if I got that correct. It's a big number. So water, if it's pure enough, is real good stuff. So by drying out the water, where you don't have to worry whether or not it contains any salt, and by running at a higher air pressure, the breakdown of the Wimpshurst machine inside the box is being controlled. Therefore, you can build up a higher voltage. In fact, when you study the Wimpshurst machine itself, as I have done it, what determines the maximum voltage you can get is the spacing between the metal strips on the disc. when you're running it at maximum potential in a dark room, you see a arcing discharge, you see a corona discharge between the individual discs, the individual metal strips on the plastic discs that are rotating. So